This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Dave Davies in for Terry Gross. You know how when you have a good idea, it sometimes seems to have just come out of the blue, like when you were walking or taking a shower? Scientists are learning more about how these creative breakthroughs happen. Our guest, Joan Allera, writes about this new science of creativity and its practical applications in the new book, Imagine: How Creativity Works. He reports that good ideas are more likely to come after a water cooler conversation or even a nap than in a workplace brainstorming session. And Lehrer looks at some ways companies are trying to incorporate this research into their workplace environments. Joan Lehrer is a contributing editor at Wired and a contributor to The New Yorker. He also appears frequently on WNYC's Radio Lab. His previous book, How We Decide, reported on what scientists are learning about how we make decisions. Joan Lehrer, welcome back to Fresh Air.
Thanks so much for having me.
You open the book with a story about Bob Dylan at a point early in his career when he was frustrated, creatively exhausted, ready to bail from the music business, and from this came a lesson about creativity. What was going on in his career?
So it's May 1965, and he's just returned from a grueling tour, 6 months tour. He's just finished touring in the UK, and he is burnt out. He doesn't know what kind of songs he wants to sing anymore. All he knows is that his old songs, these folk songs like Times They Are Change and Blown in the Wind, he's done with them. He's tired of being the poet of rock and roll. And so he tells his manager that he's quitting the music business. He's done with the singing, done with the songwriting. He's going to move to a cabin in Woodstock, New York. Doesn't even bring his guitar. He's going to be a novelist and a painter. He's there for a couple days when he is visited by this thing he calls the ghost. He gets a sudden urge to write, gets out his pen, gets out his paper, and just begins to scribble. He later describes it as like this uncontrollable rush of vomit. And really what he's trying to capture there is just this feeling that you can't hold this back. It's just this rush of words that needs to be written down. And so he begins writing and writing and writing, writes dozens of pages. And within these dozens of pages is this chorus, and it's the chorus of Like a Rolling Stone. 4 weeks later, he's in Studio A, Columbia Records, and after just four takes, they cut it on acetate, and that becomes his defining single, the six-minute single, which really changes the sound of rock and roll.
And as you've researched the subject, you find that there are other people that have this experience of being exhausted, of hitting a wall, of being empty, and then in this moment of insight are suddenly given these new bursts of creativity. What's going on?
Yeah, moments of insight are a very well-studied psychological phenomenon. And there really are two defining features. The first defining feature is the answer comes out of the blue. So it comes when we least expect it. It comes when we've quit the music business and we're trying to paint a canvas in Woodstock, New York. It comes when we've given up, when we feel like we have nothing left to say. It comes in the shower. It comes in the bathtub. It comes under the apple tree. So it comes in the least expected moments. That's the first defining feature. The second defining feature is that as soon as the answer arrives, we know this is the answer we've been looking for. We don't have to double check the math or carefully edit the lyrics. We know this is it. So the answer comes attached with this feeling of certainty. It feels like a revelation. So these are the two defining features of these moments of insight, and they do seem to play a big role in creativity, especially when people are looking for really radical solutions to very, very hard problems.
And this happens not just with artists like Dylan. It happens with people that are working on, you know, molecular biology, all kinds of fields, right?
Yeah, it's described by Richard Feynman. He had some moments of insight in his favorite strip club. It's Archimedes in the bathtub. It's Isaac Newton under the apple tree. This is a universal feature of human experience. We all have moments of insight, even if they're not quite as grandiose as writing the lyrics to Like a Rolling Stone. We all have these epiphanies, and they come in the shower. They come when we least expect them.
So if you're in the business of innovation, if you run a company where original ideas really matter, you'd want to help people create circumstances under which these moments of insight are more likely to occur. You write about the 3M company, which has a remarkable record over the years of invention. What do they do to help promote these occurrences?
Well, I think the success of 3M, the best way to understand the success of 3M is actually to talk about some other research which has been done on these moments of insight. And what scientists have found is that it's possible to do a pretty good job of predicting which people will actually have these moments of insight, at least in the lab. And that's by hooking people up to EEG machines, which is like wearing a bulky shower cap that measures the waves of electricity pouring out of your head. And what they find is that people who are more relaxed, people who exhibit lots of alpha wave activity, which is closely associated with states of relaxation, people who are in good moods, that they solve a lot more insight puzzles. That if you show someone a clip of Robin Williams doing stand-up for 5 minutes, they'll solve 20% more of these compound remote associate problems. If you know, if someone's in a good mood, they'll solve more problems. If they're in a blue room, which is a relaxing shade of blue, they will solve twice as many of these inside problems. So we've learned to discover the impact of mood and being able to relax ourselves. This also explains, of course, why the shower is such a rich source of epiphanies, because we are very relaxed. We're letting ourselves daydream. We also can't take our smartphones into the shower, at least not yet. So we're not always interrupting that effective thought process. And so I think what 3M has learned how to do is to – and they've been doing this for decades and decades. And they are a – you know, they've got an incredible track record of innovation. And I think one of the things they discovered fairly early on was the importance of giving people control over their own attention. So this began with the bootlegging hour. It began with the 15% rule, as they officially call it.
Bootlegging hour, did
you
say? Which means what?
So it's the – every engineer, every researcher at 3M has an hour of their day that they can do whatever they want. They can work on a side project. They can play a hobby. You know, it doesn't have to be directly relevant. They don't have to justify it to their boss. All they have to do is promise to share it with their colleagues. And, you know, and so this really sent an important message, I think, early on that, you know, we've hired you. We think you're smart. We trust you. We trust you to find solutions. You manage your attention in your own way. So if being productive means taking a nap in the couch, okay. If it means going for a walk on our 500-acre campus, that's okay too. If it means sitting at your desk and staring at your computer screen, that's okay. So they trust their employees, I think, at a very fundamental level to manage their own attention. And I think when one looks at the research on individual creativity, that's a really good thing, because sometimes, you know, the things that generate those moments of insight aren't things that look productive from the outside. Your boss may think you're wasting time. You're taking a nap in the, you know, couch in the sun. And yet when you look at where our insights come from, they often come when we least expect them. You know, in fact, that's one of the defining features of moments of insight, that they only arrive after we stop looking for them. So if you're an engineer and you're stumped by your technical problem, chugging caffeine at your desk and chaining yourself to your computer, you're going to be really frustrated. You're going to waste lots of time. You may look productive, but you're actually wasting time. So instead, at that moment, you should go for a walk. You should play some ping pong. You should find a way to relax.
And why do blue rooms make you more likely to have moments of insight?
Well, so this is a well-done experiment where they actually brought in 650 subjects and put some of them in red rooms and exposed them to the color red, and some people exposed to the color blue. And what they found is that people exposed to the color red, they perform better on tasks that require attention and vigilance. So copy editing, you know, long division, arithmetic, stuff like that. And that's because red reminds us of stop signs and blood and danger. So we become more attentive and aware. Blue rooms, and the color blue, on the other hand, makes us think of the ocean and the sky. So we think in more relaxed associations. We think in more abstract terms. And when you need to solve a difficult creative puzzle, that's a really good thing. So that seems to explain, that's at least the scientists argue, that's why blue rooms come with this creative perk.
Tell the story about the mops.
So I begin the book by talking about a frustrating challenge for Procter & Gamble, which was they wanted to invent a new line of soaps for their mops. This seemed like a relatively straightforward chemistry question. And so they gave it to a team of chemists who struggled for years to come up with a stronger soap, because it turns out that you can make a soap stronger, but then you may peel the varnish off wood floors, you may irritate delicate skin. It's actually a very tough chemistry problem. So after a couple years of struggle and failure, the executives at Procter & Gamble decided, okay, you know, enough with these chemists. Let's just outsource this problem. So they gave it to a design firm called Continuum, which is based outside Boston. And the guys at Continuum began by spending 9 months watching people mop their floor. The first thing they discovered, and this took several months of careful observation.
So instead of – they got out of the chemistry lab
watched people. They said, we don't know more chemistry than the chemists at Procter & Gamble. At the time, Procter & Gamble had more PhDs on staff than any other company in the world. So this was an innovation powerhouse. And the guys at Continuum, you know, said, we're not going to out-chemistry these chemists. You know, maybe we should just watch people mop. So they watch people mop, and I've seen some of these videotapes, and they're as tedious as they sound. You're watching people mop their floor, splashing around dirty water in the bathtub. And the first thing they discovered is that mopping is a terrible idea, that people spend more time cleaning their cleaning tool, cleaning the mop, than do cleaning the actual floor. And that's for the very simple reason that mops over the years had been designed to attract dirt, to pick dirt up off the floor. But that made it very tough to get the dirt out of the mop head. And so you watch these videos of people splashing around dirty, filthy water, struggling in vain to get their mop clean, but the mop can't be cleaned. And so then they just end up putting the dirty water back on the floor. It becomes very clear that mopping is a bad technology, that we need something better. But they didn't know how to replace it. And so then one day they're making yet another field visit. And it's an elderly lady, and they surreptitiously spilled some coffee on her floor, because one of the things you find when you make site visits and you tell people who are coming to watch you clean your floor is that they clean their floor before you actually get there, you know, because they want the house to be spotless. But then you're not really seeing how people do it. And so they intentionally spilled some coffee on her floor, and then they watched how she cleaned it up. And although this lady said that she always vacuumed and mopped, that's not what she did. Instead, she got out her paper towels and tore a paper towel and wet them with some water, and then wiped it along the floor. And right there, that is when they had their big idea, and that's where the Swiffer came from.
Which is essentially a disposable cover that goes on an extension like a mop.
Yeah, it's the pole of a mop but with a disposable wipe on the end. And in cleaning tests, it turns out to be very effective. People like it more because they can see how, you know, they can see the dirt they get off. And it solves the basic problem of mops, which is that it's tough to come up with a tool, a mop head, which is both good at getting dirt off the floor and also being able to get the dirt out of the mop head.
So we've been talking about insight, these sort of flashes of knowledge that come to us from we don't know where.
Yeah.
You write that there's another way another kind of brilliance, which is kind of the blue collar way, just pounding away at it.
Yeah.
Focus and persistence, and people use amphetamines. I mean, I think of this as the kind of thing that would be helpful for an interstate truck driver. But you write that it is also helpful to poets and artists.
I mean, it'd be wonderful if the recipe for all kinds of creativity was just to take showers and play ping pong and go on vacation and go for walks on the beach. But when you really talk to people in the creative business, you know, they want to tell their romantic stories about the epiphanies. But then if you really push them, they talk about, well, even that epiphany, I had to go through lots of edits on it and iterations. And there's still lots of red pen on the page. And there's still lots of hard work after we have the big idea. That's a big part of the creative process too. And it's not as fun. In fact, there's interesting evidence that it actually makes us melancholy and a little bit depressed. But it's a crucial part of creating something interesting and worthwhile. If creativity were always easy, we're just about these blinding flashes, you know, Pablo Picasso wouldn't be so famous. So when you also tell the story of creativity, and what's interesting to me about telling the story is about telling it from the perspective of the brain. And so you can see that this kind of creativity requires very different circuits. It depends on very different brain areas than those moments of insight coming from the back of the right hemisphere. But it's still a crucial part of the creative process.
Yeah, talk about the neurology of that kind of creativity.
So in the book, I begin this chapter on this blue collar kind of creativity, as you describe it, and I love that phrase, by telling the story of W.H. Auden, who in the late 1930s moved to America and is introduced to amphetamines, benzedrine, by an editor. And at first it was great because it allowed him to write during the day and then go to nightclubs during the evening. But he quickly discovered that these amphetamines came with this productive perk, which is that they let him focus for hours and hours at a time on a single line of poetry, on a single metaphor. And so he could really drill down and keep on editing until it was crystalline and perfect, until his poems were just transparent and so beautiful. And when you look at the career of Auden, His most anthologized poems often come from his benzedrine phase, come from this period when he was writing poems which were very, very clear and very, very elegant. And poems like September 1st, 1939, which, you know, it's in so many anthologies. And so I was interested in how this pill, and many writers have taken benzedrine, from Philip K. Dick to Jack Kerouac to Auden, how this pill influenced his actual output. And I think what it helped him do was stick with the poems until they were perfect, until there wasn't a single flabby line and, you know, an excess metaphor. You know, they were just really, really well edited. And that's when, in his case, benzedrine helped him do. Of course, you know, benzedrine and other amphetamines come with all sorts of terrible side effects, and they're very, very addictive, which is why they're now illegal and Auden struggled for years to quit. But they also allowed him to persist with his poetry until it was perfect.
You also find that there's a correlation between negative moods, specifically depression, and creativity. And I mean, this, of course, conforms to the stereotype of the tortured artist. Is there evidence that this is the case?
Yeah, so I think one of the surprising things that's emerged from the study of moods in recent years has been that putting people in a bad mood, making them a little bit sad, a little bit melancholy, actually comes with some cognitive benefit. So you can induce sadness pretty easily in a lab. You can show people a 5-minute video about death and cancer, and sure enough, they'll be a little downcast after that. Then you can give them various tests. You can give them tests of attention and memory. You can ask them to make a collage and then have an independent panel of judges assess all the collages. And what you find is that people who you've made a little bit sad will make better collages because they'll persist longer. They'll remember more. They'll be more attentive. So they'll score higher on all these metrics. So sadness, you know, although it, of course, isn't fun, it's not pleasant, it does sharpen the mind a little bit. And one of the longstanding mysteries in the field of creativity has been this correlation, and this was first identified by Kay Redfield Jamison and others, between people suffering from various kinds of depression, especially bipolar depression, and creative output. And depending on the study you look at, the people who are successful creators, especially successful writers, that's the best studied field, are anywhere between 8 and 40 times more likely to suffer from bipolar depression than the general public. And really no one's known what to make of this. It's tough to associate creativity with mental illness because obviously if you're very ill, it just gets in the way. We can't think through it. The suffering is too intense. But one of the theories now is that the terrible swings of the mental illness, of manic depression, of bipolar depression. You get these manic highs, these euphorias when the ideas just pour out of you and you need to write them down. That's followed by this dismal low period when maybe you're a better editor, when maybe it's easier for you to focus and refine those epiphanies into, a perfect form and to persist with draft after draft after draft. So the thinking now is that maybe this correlation between bipolar depression and artistic production exists because the awful swings of the mental illness, in a sense, echo the natural swings of the creative process.
You also write about improvisation. You talk about watching Yo-Yo Ma interpret and perform a piece and also improvisational comics. There's something in common here. What's going on neurologically in this kind of creativity?
So this is very interesting work done at Johns Hopkins, where what they did was they actually put jazz pianists in an fMRI machine, and they had them first play a melody they'd memorized in advance, and they had them play an improvised melody. And what they discovered is that before the improv began, these expert jazz pianists turned off a part of the brain called the dorsolateral prefrontal cortex. It's just behind your forehead. And there's a sharp drop in activity in this brain area. And this is a part of the brain which is closely associated with impulse control. So it keeps us from saying stupid stuff. It keeps us from eating too much chocolate cake, from shoplifting. It allows us to act like mature adults, in other words. And yet what these improvisational artists, what these spontaneous performers are able to do is when the situation demanded it, they could just silence it. They could inhibit their inhibitions on command. And that allowed them to create without worrying about what they're creating. And I think when you're in the improv business, that's a big part of what the job is all about. It's about learning how to let yourself go, learning how to play like a little kid without worrying about playing the wrong note or drawing outside the box. You're just interested in the process of creation. And when I got to spend some time at Second City, the famous improv club in school, and you watch these performers warm up, you realize that they actually call it getting out of your head. They call their warm-up exercise, now we're going to get out of our heads. And they do stuff like they walk around in circles making flatulent noises, so farting sounds. And then they'll have a 5-minute confessional where they've got to say something really embarrassing without thinking about just how embarrassing it is. And so all their warm-up exercises are really about learning how to turn off that part of the brain to learning how to let themselves go.
And how does that work with Yo-Yo Ma? What does he do that's distinct and that involves sort of shutting off those inhibitions?
Well, I think for Yo-Yo, it really is about learning how to relax. So he told me this great story about before he goes out on stage, he often thinks about Julia Child. And at first I was, why Julia Child? And he tells this wonderful story about the great thing about Julia Child is, she'd be making a roast chicken and it looked beautiful. And then she'd be talking to the camera and the chicken would just fall off the plate, fall onto the floor. And he said, did she make this look of horror? Did she scream? No, no. She smile never left her face. She picked up the chicken, dusted it off, and just went on with the show. And he says that's an inspiring story to think about when you're in the midst of performance, because you're going to make a mistake. And your attitude has to be, I welcome that first mistake because now I'm free. And it's that attitude, that you know, the lesson of Julia Child, which I think allows him to create and emote and play beautiful sounds and very complicated sounds without worrying too much about playing the wrong note, about making a mistake. Because if you're too worried about that, you're going to be paralyzed. You won't be able to fully express the emotions you need to express.
So it's a trade-off between, in some sense, concentrating on the technical details and the emotion of it, right?
Exactly. You know, he describes his favorite creative moment as being half conscious and half unconscious, where you are fully absorbed in the frets, in the notes, in the strings, in the sound, in those notes on the page. But part of you is also just letting yourself go. Part of you is not worrying at all about what you're doing. You're just in the moment.
So this kind of creativity, which is sort of shutting off your inhibitions, which means kind of what deactivating the dorsolateral prefrontal cortex.
Yes.
If I've got that.
Yeah.
It would help Yo-Yo Ma. It would help improvisational comics. Does it also help, you know, scientists, you know, biomedical researchers, that kind of thing too?
Yeah, I mean, I think so. I mean, this is best studied in, you know, in the mode of creative performance. These people, when you think about it, it's totally astonishing that a jazz performer can just walk out on stage and have no idea what they're going to play and just trust their brain to create something beautiful. But I think it's a kind of thinking which we can all benefit from. It's the kind of thinking that kids engage in naturally. So the dorsolateral prefrontal cortex is one of the last brain areas to come online. And one theory is that it helps explain what educators refer to as the fourth grade slump. So it's about in fourth grade when all of a sudden kids lose interest in drawing and painting and art projects in school, because all of a sudden they're aware that you can draw the wrong line, you can put the brush in the wrong place, that you can make mistakes, that their works of art don't quite live up to their expectations and don't quite look like what they're trying to draw. And that kind of self-awareness does get in the way. It does get in the way of our natural innovation. There's a quote about Picasso about every child is born an artist. The problem is what happens when we grow up. So I think we can learn to recover this kind of childish exuberance. We can learn how to not hold ourselves back.
There's a fascinating study that you describe where two groups of people are given a set of facts and are asked to come up with some ideas. And the one difference in the set of instructions is one group is told at first, pretend you're 7 years old.
Yeah.
And then what are the results between the two groups?
the group who pretended they were 7 years old solved a lot more problems. This was a divergent thinking task. So it's stuff like come up with more uses for a brick, solve various inside puzzles. And the group that pretended they were 7 years old, even though they're just pretending for a couple minutes, solved a lot more of them. And that gets us back to the benefits of this childish kind of creativity, the letting go process, that simply by remembering what it was like to be a little kid, we were able to become more creative.
So you should begin your day by pretending you're a kid.
Yeah. Begin with a hot shower and pretend you're a seven-year-old.
Well, Joan O'Leary, it's been really interesting. Thanks so much.
Thanks so much for having me.
Joan O'Leary's new book is called Imagine: How Creativity Works. You'll find a longer version of our conversation online at freshair.npr.org. The AMC series Mad Men, winner of the Best Drama Series Emmy for each of its four seasons to date, returns with Season 5 on Sunday, March 25th. This comes after a 17-month hiatus. Our TV critic David Biancooley asks whether the long-overdue start of this new season was worth the wait, and starts by answering that very question.
Yes, it was worth the wait. Absolutely. Mad Men returns Sunday with a 2-hour season premiere. And by the time it's over, if you react the way I did, you'll be satisfied and even comforted to have spent 2 wonderful hours with the folks at Sterling Cooper Draper Price. Series creator Matthew Weiner has created something magical with Mad Men, and that magic spell continues in Season 5. This show has a pace and feel all its own, and the writers, actors, and directors all attack with the cocky confidence of John Hamm's Don Draper entering a conference room to woo a new client. These characters have been delineated so richly over the years that spending time with them this season is not only a pleasure, it's a constant series of small but revealing discoveries. When Elizabeth Moss, as Peggy, snaps at Dawn after she has a bit too much to drink, it's underplayed, but it's obviously a bold move that results in a series of aftershocks. So is the power play by Vincent Kartheiser's Pete, who's bringing in more clients than many others in the office, and doesn't want that fact to go unnoticed or unrewarded. Secrecy and mystery are big parts of Mad Men, especially between seasons, so there's no point in getting specific here. Yes, as usual, the new season begins sometime after the previous season ended, allowing the plot to jump ahead a bit, but I won't say how long. Nor will I say what most Mad Men fans seem to want to know. Did Don really marry Megan, the secretary to whom he proposed, impulsively and quite shockingly, in the fourth season finale? And if you remember that proposal, you really are a fan, because that was televised way back in 2010. All I'll say is that Megan still is a part of Don's life, and they appear at first to be getting along quite well. That's true at work, where Don, played by John Hamm, takes the opportunity to ditch Pete Campbell and meet with Megan, played by Jessica Paré, in his office behind closed doors, at which point he immediately embraces her.
Let's get out of here.
No.
Then lock the door.
As soon as I'm in here longer than 5 minutes, people start to...
What? Who?
I have to get these to Peggy. I have a presentation, you know.
I can make you go home right now, you know, I have that power.
Mr. Campbell is here to see you.
I just saw him.
I have to get back to work.
Open your blouse.
You're a dirty old man. Anything else?
No, ma'am.
I'm sorry, am I interrupting?
Megan and Don also appear to be getting along outside of work, but appearances can be deceiving. Don may be calm and carefree on the surface, but he's always churning underneath. Season 5 begins with him facing his 40th birthday, and a surprise party, at which Megan, as a special gift, joins the band that's been hired for the party, grabs a microphone, and sings a pretentious little song in French while giving him the 1960s equivalent of a lap dance. Because it's Don Draper, it's impossible to register his true reaction. But it'll come out sooner or later. Once again, here's Jessica Paré as Megan.
1, 2, 3, 4.
The opening hours of Mad Men this season are about office politics and personal relationships. But the world that's percolating outside, at this point in the 60s, can't be held at bay for long. And it isn't. Mad Men is a show devoted to its era and determined to strip away any undeserved nostalgia. So race, war, and drugs all come into play. But Mad Men also is about our times, and the timeless ebb and flow of intimate relationships, professional status, and secret yearnings. Mad Men, even after such a long hibernation, is a show for all seasons. It's great to have it back, and it's as great as ever.
David Bianculli is founder and editor of the website TV Worth Watching and teaches TV and film history at Rowan University in New Jersey. After the break, actress Sonia Sohn. I'm Dave Davies. And this is Fresh Air Weekend. This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Dave Davies in for Terry Gross. If you've listened to Fresh Air over the years, you know that many of us here were big fans of the HBO series The Wire, about drug gangs, kids, and cops in Baltimore, Maryland. Our guest, Sonia Sohn, played Police Detective Kima Greggs on The Wire. When the series was over, she wanted to help young people in East Baltimore, like those portrayed in the series. So with the help of some colleagues, she started a 2-year pilot program called Rewired for Life, working with kids who'd been arrested multiple times and were about to do serious time. She used scenes from The Wire as a jumping-off point to help them discuss problems they were having and how they could change their lives. Then Soane worked with a second group, a little older, with different needs. They were quitting dealing drugs, had no GED, and needed support and advice. Now known as Rewired for Change, the programs also turned a church-owned house into a village house, a safe place for members of the community to gather. Soane's goal is to keep Rewired going and expand its reach. Sonia Soane now travels back and forth between Baltimore and L.A., where she currently plays homicide detective Samantha Baker in ABC's Body of Proof. Before we get to Terry's interview with Sonia Soane, let's listen to a scene from The Wire. Here, Detective Kima Greggs, played by Soane, and Officer Carver, played by Seth Gilliam, have observed a well-dressed man in a nice car being handed a trash bag. So they stop him. Soane's character, Kima Greggs, speaks first.
Step out of the car, sir.
What'd I do?
Step out of the car. Go run him up on me.
Man, look, I'm already late.
Put your hand to the roof, please, sir.
Sir, you were observed in one of the city's designated drug-free anti-loitering zones, where a drug suspect leaned into your vehicle handing you something. And when we signaled for you to stop, you were leaning over as if attempting to conceal something beneath the passenger side seat.
Come on now, look, enough of this now, come on.
Is there something beneath that seat, sir?
Nah, no.
Then you don't mind if we take a look, right?
Sonia Soane, welcome to Fresh Air. So you're an actress. After you were finished shooting The Wire, why did you want to stay in East Baltimore and work with young people who are out on parole and try to help them straighten out their lives? I mean, that's, you're not a social worker, you're an actress.
You know, Terry, my journey to becoming an actress is not your typical one. I didn't, you know, strive to become an actress all my life. I didn't. It's not some goal that I had. This career essentially, you know, chased me down while I was on the spoken word scene in New York. I kept hearing that my delivery of my poetry, which was very personal and cathartic at the time, was, I guess, very moving to folks. And people thought that I was an actress because of my delivery when I was just dropping into the work and really, you know, pouring out my soul. It seems like I just couldn't escape this sort of career chasing me, so I decided to stop, turn around, and face it. I realized that there's something internal that I could gain from pursuing this career as an actor. However, once I got into the business, I really abhor, you know, what this career can sort of drum up, you know, inside of a person. You know, it really plays on your ego, and I had a really tough time with that sort of battling that and trying to, you know, balance that out. During the first season of The Wire, I almost quit.
Why would you quit The Wire?
It was painful. It was torturous.
What was torturous about it?
By the time I'd gotten The Wire, I was experienced. I studied for 5 years in New York, and, you know, I was ready. But I got on the set, and I found myself, after hours of preparation, you know, every day, you know, I found myself, you know, blanking out on my lines, you know, and I saw, you know, the reaction of, you know, my coworkers and, you know, the sort of tension, you know, as the takes are clapping away, you know, and the time's, you know, ticking and the money's, you know, being spent. You know, and I started feeling very humiliating, going, what is going on? Am I really this bad an actress? And I got very disheartened, and I couldn't for the life of me figure it out. And I, you know, barreled through. But it was extraordinarily painful for me because there were days on the set where I felt humiliated.
Did you ever figure it out? Like, why were you suddenly?
Absolutely, I figured it out. You know, I had done a tremendous amount of work, you know, personal work, you know, on my own, you know, because of, you know, the type of, you know, trauma and abuse and whatnot that I had grown up with. And I realized that what was happening was, you know, I was, you know, working in neighborhoods that were very reminiscent of the neighborhoods that I grew up in. I was, you know, seeing, you know, people that reminded me of the people I grew up with. Essentially, you know, on some level, you know, experiencing a re-traumatization. And my brain was just short-circuiting all over the place. The other thing I was working out that first season was my relationship to law enforcement and police. It was really difficult that first season to play a cop.
Well, what did you think of cops when you were growing up? What was your relationship to cops?
My relationship to cops, you know, wasn't, you know, a very good one. My perception of cops was that they, you know, came into your neighborhood, they roughed up people that you loved for no reason and took them away. I mean, as a young child, you sort of saw that. But I think for me, on a deeper level, there were times when I called the police to come to my home because my mother was being abused. And to call the police is a really, yeah, it's a really big deal to call the police because you don't snitch. You don't, you know, that's sort of the culture that you grew up in. But you certainly don't want to call the police on your father. But if I thought my mother's life was in danger, I would pick up the phone and I would call the cops. And at that point, then it's like, oh, I'm calling them. They essentially didn't do anything about the situation. They would come and, you know, the moment would be, you know, quelled. But, you know, eventually I did want them to take my father away because this was, you know, really painful to live with. And then one time, the last time I called the cops, they came to the house, and it was a pretty serious altercation that day. And I thought, surely something's going to happen here. They're going to, you know, take my father away. And I saw the cops look at each other. I saw one cop look at the other and roll his eyes and smirk and kind of laugh. And that angered me so deeply. You know, I believe, like, that sealed, you know, the inner sort of dislike and, you know, I would even say hatred at that point of the cops. And so I had to overcome all of that to play this cop.
Kima really loved the work. I mean, she got shot and nearly died in the course of The Wire, but she went back to the job afterwards, insisted that she didn't want to just stay put in desk work. She was willing to put her life on the line. She was, you know, on the whole, pretty fearless, responsible, but, you know, not afraid to take risks. How did you physically handle yourself when you were growing up? You're not a large woman. How tall are you?
I'm 5'5".
Okay, it's like you're not short, but you're not tall either, and you're certainly not imposing. Like, no one's going to look at you and feel like, wow, I'm scared, you know?
No, especially not running around the neighborhood with two ponytails. You know,
no.
All my friends got Afro puffs, you know. You know, I'm already sticking out like a sore thumb. I got to tell you, there's a moment where my mom sent me out of the house one day with a broomstick. And you know, a boy had been teasing me, and, you know, my mom's Korean, and so I was getting a lot of Chinese this, Chinese that, yin, yang, 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 you know, yeah, kids can be, you know. And I came home crying, and my mom was like, I'm sick of this. She gave me a broom handle, and she put it in my hands, and she marched me to the, you know, the door, and she pushed me out the door, and she told me to go beat his, you know, XYZ. And I went, whoa, you know, if your mom's sending you outside to kick some butt and you got permission to do it, then, you know, you got to go do it. You can't turn around and run back. And the boy was sitting at the top of the sliding board, and I marched up the sliding board, and he just did not think I was going to, you know, go through with it. I cracked him upside the head with the broom handle. He went reeling down the slide. And, you know, for the rest of the, I got a good 6 months out of that, you know, no one messed with me for about 6 months. The girls were all on my side. I mean, you know, and it's a funny little story, but it's also pretty sad.
I know you've spoken in the past about how one of the problems you eventually got into was drugs, and that's, I'm sure, another way that you can relate both to characters in The Wire and also to the young people you're trying to help now in East Baltimore. What was your story about how you started using and what it was you used?
Well, I first smoked pot when I was 11 years old. And, you know, initially it's just, you know, a bunch of 11 and 12-year-olds, you know, experimenting with pot. You know, a lot of us had older brothers who were drug dealers. And so, you know, we found the weed. And
You had an older brother as a drug dealer?
Yeah, he was 5 years older than me. And he was selling weed at the time. And, you know, most of my friends had older brothers who hung out with each other, and they were all at least selling weed and participating in other criminal behavior, you know, like theft and whatnot. But, you know, initially you don't think you're smoking pot to, you know, get away from, you know, stress. You know, you think you're just having fun. But by the time I was 13, I was smoking every day. I realize now that that coincided with the time in my life when I had just given up on things being any different at home. I had spent a lot of my childhood trying to fix my family and trying to find a way to make this work to so that I could be home and I could be happy, including, you know, probably four or five years trying to convince my mother to leave my father. And, you know, all I wanted was to be happy. I wanted some peace.
So did it just stay marijuana or did you move on to other drugs?
Like 13, 14, we were doing, we were smoking weed, speed, acid. And then later on in high school, probably my senior year in high school is when I was introduced to coke. And essentially, I would say coke is, you know, what, you know, once I started doing coke, that's when things start to get hairy.
You mentioned that your older brother and the older brothers of a lot of your friends sold drugs. Your brother, I believe, correct me if I'm wrong, was murdered. Would you mind talking about what happened?
This was back in 1988. My my brother had actually, you know, hit, you know, a bottom. You know, he had had quite a reputation growing up in our town. You know, in his, you know, mid-20s, things started to go sour for him. And, you know, which eventually happens to, you know, anyone in that lifestyle. He decided to move down to North Carolina, where my father had my father and my mother eventually divorced after I was in high school. At any rate, he was living with my uncle, and my uncle lived next door to a young woman whose boyfriend was abusive to her physically. And from time to time, my brother would see her on the street and would talk to her. And the boyfriend knew this and essentially told my brother to stay away from his girlfriend. And my brother wasn't trying to date her or anything, but he was consoling her and was, you know, essentially giving her some advice and whatnot. But, you know, essentially a jealous boyfriend, you know, shot my brother and killed him.
You had mentioned earlier that before you were cast in The Wire, you did slam poetry. And you co-wrote and starred in the movie Slam. And that's how you were kind of discovered as an actor, that people saw you performing your poetry and thought, well, you should be acting because you perform it so well. Could I ask you to do something from that period for us to give us a sense
goodness.
Of what you were writing and what you were thinking at that earlier phase in your life when you were first starting to perform and to articulate your thoughts?
Sure, Terry. I can't say that I will remember an entire poem, but I can give you a little tidbit.
A little tidbit is fine.
I had actually left the poetry scene to study acting. After 5 years, my coach said to me that she thought I was ready and that she was convinced that if someone saw me, that they would give me an opportunity. And she said, you just got to get on stage any way that you know how, and you know how to get on stage. And so she sent me back to the poetry scene, and I was just appalled. But, you know, I looked up to her, and so I decided to go back. When I went back, I basically had to bring out the old work. And this is a poem that I read on stage 9 months after she sent me back. And Mark Levin was in the audience. He was there to see the young man that he had chosen to be the lead of the film Slam. And when he heard this poem, he realized that it resonated the theme of the film, and they were looking for a female lead for the movie. And that's, you know, that's how this poem is actually sort of responsible for my career. And it's called Run Free. I feel like my back is against the brick wall, and I got a Mack truck 2 inches from my face. Every cell in my body is screaming, run, but I can't. My mind drifts. I think about the last time I ran, left my baby with two coke heads on acid. I can't, that's the beginning.
Okay.
And I'll jump all over the place. But that's the beginning of that.
Sounds good. Had you actually left your baby with two cokeheads on acid?
One was my sister and the other my best friend. that's the next line. Yeah. And it's something about what was I thinking, kind of like my brain was busted, frying on the hot concrete of my life run amok, dripping down the dead body of my soul, collecting into pools of blood at my feet. I'm kicking and stomping and running and jumping, wreaking all kinds of havoc, creating a bloody mess, and I am going nowhere. Somewhere in my mind, I am moving. Somewhere in reality, I am running. Somewhere inside myself, I am, oh, so still, quiet, dead. My soul is not rising. My heart is not lifting. My life is not living. But I am running, moving through the universe, a whirling dervish with no end, no purpose, no means, no life left to live. And yet still I want to go to that place where I can run free, my mind tells me. But those two words cannot occupy the same space in reality. Run free. My back is against a brick wall. I got a Mack truck 2 inches from my face. Well, run free, baby, right now. Just turn around and go. Clip all the wires, hookups, and hangups, and then you're home free. You can give birth to an excuse so easily you believe it's always been there. Part of the natural order made to order by your forever clever mind, constantly making you believe in things you no longer need to believe in. And I believe like a holy roller, singing, sweating, preaching, go tell it on the mountain, diving in 10,000 feet of baptismal water without a life preserver. I believe like my bullet-ridden brother out there somewhere, dying, bleeding, gurgling blood through his last breath, spitting out a red ripe prayer, so new, so sweet, so baby fresh, he thinks he can save his life. Brutal honesty won't knock down the doors of heaven, but it'll damn sure crash the gates of hell. So I believe any and everything that sprouts from my colossally imperfect mind, because in this moment I have a Mack truck 2 inches from my face and a brick wall kissing my ass. God does not exist in desperation, and hope is lying dead somewhere in the sewer, down the street, around the corner, underneath the feet of someone in the alley.
Wow.
Woo! It's been a long time. It's been a long time, Terry.
Sonia Sohn speaking with Terry Gross. Sohn played Detective Kima Greggs on The Wire and now plays Detective Samantha Baker on ABC's Body of Proof. Sohn co-founded Rewired for Change, a community program based in East Baltimore whose goal is to help at-risk youth turn their lives around. Fresh Air Weekend was produced by John Myers. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. For Terry Gross, I'm Dave Davies. This is Fresh Air Weekend.